Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we are joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the magnificent Sue Perkins.
A pleasure.
And as you can hear, we're coming recorded from the London Podcast Festival. It's already going well, isn't it?
We're coming to you delayed.
Yeah. there is the longest possible delay for swearing we can do, which is months.
Yeah.
It's great having you on, Sue. Thanks for coming on this. What's really interesting, what's lovely about this, is having a chance to talk to you about comedy. Because I think one of the things that's happened with your career is you're very much associated now with sort of documentary and reality and doing other things. But your background is 100% comedy. You were Footlights and...
Yeah, just always a silly wig and a plastic chicken. That was me, whether they wanted it or not, for 10 years. Mel and I started the first ever Edinburgh Festival we did. Mel wrote me a letter, which was very formal, which said, "Dear Susan..." and I'd known her for 3 years, so we'd been very, very good mates.
Did you think you were in trouble?
I know, I was panicked. And of course, in those days, no email, no nothing. You get a letter in the post. "Dear Susan, would you like to be in a double act with me? Love, Melanie."
Have you still got it? That's the first question.
I have still got it. And I said no. And the rest is, yeah. No, so it was very, very formal, because I think we just felt awkward about perhaps moving a friendship into potentially a sort of business partnership. That it's always first and foremost been about being chums. And yeah, so the first Edinburgh we did in classic Mel Sue sort of tradition was sorted out very late. We didn't decide to go to Edinburgh till April. Most of the venues had been booked up, and we ended up with a 10:05 slot.
In the morning,
10:05.
No one's awake.
Exactly, and 10:05 as well, which meant that any 10 o'clock show people would go to, and it was only the ones that had missed the show they really wanted to see at 10.
Were you after a 5-minute show? Was Morph up that
I don't know what the staggering of 5 minutes was down to, but we hadn't actually finished writing the show, so it would... It sort of gently disintegrated. Yeah, it sort of didn't have an ending. So it ended in the end. We just used to... We shone a torch on a croissant. That was the end of it. And again, that really sums us up, I think.
That's a classic act structure. If you see a croissant in Act 1, a torch will be shone on it in Act 3.
It was a bit of reincorporation.
Very much presaging your later baking.
Yes, it was.
That cakes the store.
Very true. We then went on to spend 7 years shining a light on other people's croissants. But yeah. And we thought, thought about it like that. Very, very true. And we had nobody came to the first show we ever did. One person came to the second show. And because we're professionals, we carried on. And she didn't take her rucksack off, so she sat...
Tilted forwards.
Very tilted at a 45-degree angle. And so we just sort of saw the top of her head.
That's someone who's not only ready to leave your venue, but they're ready to leave the country.
Yes. We were interrupting her from a major excursion. And then she, in the middle of it, she got out a small map, which she then unfolded to a giant map. And she didn't shut it for the rest of the show. We were just performing to in the back of a street map of Edinburgh.
Someone who's got all the escape routes covered.
Yeah, it was. But I miss it. I loved it with all my heart. I went to Edinburgh. I go to Edinburgh every year in various incarnations. But my heart is there because that's where I made these profoundly idiotic choices and mistakes. And you know, we'd turn up with bags of props and barely rehearsed material and did appalling accents and inflicted them on theatre goers and. I loved it. I just, that feeling of freedom and experimentation never really leaves you.
Is that what has led you to love the thing you brought today so much? The subject matter of people just trapped somewhere trying to entertain?
Exactly that. Exactly that.
Can you share with the class what you have brought with you today?
Today, I have brought, for my money, the greatest film in any genre of all time. This is Spinal Tap. That's my. Yes, I think, well, when you announced it, I think that the wonderful Rufus Jones said, it's the Matterhorn, and he's right, of course. I mean, when you kindly asked me to come and do this, I thought, well, someone's bound to have done Tap. This is a podcast about comedy. Everyone will have beaten a path to your door saying tap, 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 and no one had. And then the fear came upon me because there
it's
is...
mine. Yeah,
because it is... it's a perfect comedic piece, in my opinion. It's everything about it is beautiful.
It bashes down a door that has been opened a lot since, which is, it does feel like, obviously there have been mockumentaries before, but it does, it defined and perfected a form that has been done again since, but nowhere near as well, I would argue. There's something brilliant about it, and I was trying to think what it is, and I think it's that it's really well directed. And the thing about this is Rob Reiner opens up, and the first guy you meet is the director, Marty DeBurgi. And I've noticed every time you watch Spinal Tap, new things come up. I noticed today he can't cross his arms. I'd never noticed before. He keeps trying and failing to cross his arms, like a man who's not meant to be in front of the camera. It's subtle stuff like that that you notice on the 26th viewing. But he's out there and he says, hey, I'm a film director. And you go, oh, this is about film. And Christopher Guest, who obviously is one of the big guys in Tap and is probably the heir to the form afterwards, has made loads of films, none of which have quite loved the idea of the crew and the director and the filmmaker as much as they love the characters and the acting. What's great about it is it's about making a film, about making a film about something you love, and it front and centres the form and the shape of it in a way that most improvisation is about people just enjoying performing.
You won't ever find a better backstage scene than the scene where Nigel is trying to get a large circular piece of ham on a small square piece of bread. And there's this incredible joy about that sequence. But actually, what I love watching it again and again is exactly as you say, it's the direction of the backstage mayhem. There are extras not being extras. Yeah. You're so aware of the role of the extra in most films. But I've been in a billion dressing rooms and green rooms, and they're my passion. And that's the only film where I've seen that backstage space represented faithfully.
There's
and
an
keenly,
authenticity to it, not only a truth in the performances and the acting, but an authenticity in saying this is... When I first saw it, I was a heavy metal fan. This is a glimpse behind the curtain of that. And you want to know about it. And there are little details in it that no one else would get right unless they knew about that world, about the world of touring. These guys have been in bands. I mean, Mike McKean was in a band called The Left Bank, who I adore. You can't buy their records.
He supported John Denver at one point.
They know this stuff. Little details. Wow. When Christopher Guest, as Nigel Tufnell, is wandering through their hotel suite, playing his electric guitar unplugged. Everyone I knew at school played their electric guitar unplugged, because you can't plug a guitar because it's too noisy. That noise, blah, 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 like a cheese grater, was the sound of my teenage, and I'd never heard it on film before, but that's what being in a band sounds like.
And it's the tuning up, and it's the and it's the nervous fiddlings. It's, you know, so for Nigel, it's the bends. It's the constant sort of pentatonic scale with the bends in it.
Yep.
For you know, performers, sort of comedy performers, it's pacing and running lines. But there's that sort of febrile sort of weird intensity is so perfectly sort of configured in that film. It's quite astonishing.
I think how that's achieved is amazing, because it looks like, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff, if you know improvisational films, you know improvisational comedy, and there's so much has come after this that's borrowed from it. What this does brilliantly is it seems to show you a bigger world, which you're seeing a tiny glimpse of, even down to the fact that the cameos are tiny. People are on for half a line. And the thing you know is that there were 50 hours or 100 hours, various accounts of footage made, of which you're seeing a tiny slice, which is exactly how a real documentary is made. It's not been faked. And the people are crossing over each other and getting each other's way and things. And they've chosen to show you a little bit of it. And so you feel like you're glimpsing a real world. It's got an authenticity and a realness to it that a lot of other improvised films don't have, which seem to be about picking the best from 10 performances.
Yeah, and as you say, that the edit, I mean, Rob Reiner said that the film was written in the edit. You know, they edited for 9 months. Which
9 months?
They shot for like 28, 30 days. And then imagine taking that, and it's just endless interviewing as well as the set pieces. It's this thing of great beauty that's been finessed over, you know, an enormous amount of time. I'm trying to think how long, if I do a documentary, probably an hour's worth would take 5-6 weeks in an edit.
9 months.
9 months.
But what they've done with that, I've got friends who work in documentary making. They say, well, the things that people don't understand about documentary making is there's a lot of storytelling in it. And the thing that Spinal Tap achieves, which I don't think any other improvised film does, is it simulates, by actually doing it, because we know this from pastiche, the best way of simulating something for a joke is to actually do it. If you want to do a spoof newspaper, it's as hard as a real newspaper. A spoof James Bond film is as hard to make as a real James Bond film. They've made a fake documentary in the same way as you make a real documentary, which is to shoot too much footage and then look for the story. And the story they found, when you see the if you buy the DVD of Spinal Tap, there's an hour and a half of deleted scenes, which are even longer than the film. And the stuff they've thrown out, you go, oh, that doesn't tell the story. The story they found is an amazing story, because it's not just a load of sketches about being in a band. It's the story of friends.
Mm.
And they found a story of two friends, and they tell it in the way that a real documentary maker would tell it, by dropping those scenes of friendship in order to watch their friendship ebb and flow. And there's that brilliant bit where it shows the two of them, where Nigel and David, as school children, fake photographs.
In Squatney. In Squatney.
Perfect name. In Squatney. And then it shows them, and then they sit at the cafe table and they sing All the Way Home,
the
simple song they've learned. And you go, oh, I love these guys, they've been friends forever. And then you watch as the film director, this is the genius thing, the film director shows what happens when a woman gets in.
Damn these women infecting everything.
And it's just
polluting the creativity of men.
It's exactly what that film director would do. Is he would edit to show his favourite friends having their relationship spoiled in the Linda McCartney story, the Yoko Ono story.
Yeah.
He has chosen that story because that's exactly what a man who was a childhood fan of that band would do in the edit.
Do you remember the first song that you guys ever wrote together?
All the Way Home, probably.
Yeah. All the Way Home?
Yeah.
Can you remember a little bit of it? I'd love to hear.
Christ. Some black coffee, maybe. Yeah.
How's it going?
I'm beside the railroad track, and I'm waiting for that train to bring you back. Bring me back. If she's not on the 519, then I'm gonna know what sorrow means, and I'm gonna cry, cry, cry all the way home. All the way home. All the way home.
Probably it's been like 13, 14 years since I've watched it. So watching it again recently, I came to it with a fresh perspective. But when I looked at it was that scene where Nigel is complaining that he can't build sandwiches from this miniature bread, basically.
Yeah.
Would you like bigger bread?
Yeah. And Tony Hedges is going, you don't have to keep folding it. But he just keeps...
He's got a point to make.
It was that scene where I went, oh, he's a little boy.
Yeah.
Because that's what the two of them are. They're two little boys.
He's innocent as well, Nigel. He's
yes.
a real...
Oh.
There's a sweetness and a. I mean, everyone says it's not your job to be as confused as Nigel. For me, yeah. Nigel, yeah. I mean, he can get confused, but underneath that, there's a base simplicity actually. And
it's Father Dougal, it's like a dog in human form. It's that thing.
But
you watch
him as Janine arrives, and is then obviously between him and his best friend. He gets sadder and sadder and sadder, and he's just a lost little boy. It's so delightful.
But you're absolutely right about it's made like a documentary. I mean, the documentaries I've made, particularly ones that are tent-based, you would...
Tent-based.
Some of my earlier tent-based herbs. often you'd find that you start with, say, 13 people, and you need an inroad in as an audience member. Who is this person? And it wouldn't be something they said. It would be a look. And that look would say whether they were somebody who was jealous of somebody else's chocolate, or you know, whether they were just actually a little bit lost and frightened in this sort of strange new world. And same with Tap. It's the look of Nigel when Janine comes in. And those looks are constantly then being, you know, we see more and more and more as the despair increases.
Brilliantly,
you know.
When Janine arrives, they're on stage playing a song from the early days of their band. They're playing the Thamesman song. They're having fun. So they're being kids again. And you're aware that this tour is not going so well. They're past their best. That people aren't taking them seriously. And then suddenly they're back. They're the Beatles in the cavern. And she walks in and the band falls apart at the moment that they're happy again.
Yeah.
And it's so well done. And I think one of the reasons that this film is endlessly rewatchable, and one of the things that makes a comedy film rewatchable, I think, is if a comedy film is just jokes, you can get weary of it and tired of it. And I'm a big advocate of joke, joke, joke. I love Airplane, wrote Touch of Cloth. I love just a load of jokes in order. But the rewatchability of that is limited sometimes. Whereas truth
you need
and authenticity.
Sentiment. You need something that picks away at you and that has it in spades. There's a truthfulness.
Totally.
You know, I first watched that film because I thought it would be a funny spoof of a heavy metal band. And that film has journeyed alongside with me. I have had similar, sometimes worse experiences on stage. I have played Cleveland in Stockport at one of the worst gigs of our life.
Mel and Sue and Puppet Show.
I've said it 100 times. We have done those gigs. We had an Israeli puppet theatre, and we had all the Tap jokes. And then, you know, and I'll put my hand on my heart. You know, I had the Janine moment. You know, when Mel got married, it was like, how dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you? You know, and you have to go through all that weird stuff, even in very close platonic friendships. And I love that. The Stockport gig, by the way, was an absolute nightmare because we were very young and we were just starting out, and our mate Ed said, oh, I'll tour you. It was 1995. I was about 12 years old. Nobody knew who we were. And he said, I've got a great gig. It's late. It's a late one. It's a late one. It's in a community hall. And it's a late one. It's a late one. It's 10:30. What he didn't say was who we were going on after. And it was a 2-hour sort of support group for domestic abusers and those who had been abused. And no one told us. And so the theme tune that we played for the start of our sketch show was Mrs. Mills. And if you know Mrs. Mills, yes. A very jolly old lady. And then they just finished the video screen was just full of horrific images. And then literally the sound guy just changed from the screams of an innocent being attacked to ning, 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 ning. And it was just, and in we came in our sort of day glow suits doing silly acts, awful. But we did get to say, hello, Cleveland. And why I love Tap is because we have died a million times and we've always had that as glue. It's like, there is that thing of knowing that, oh God, we are awful, but this will be an anecdote. One day in 10, 20, 30 years' time, we will find mirth in this horror.
There's a great thing where...
the same can't be said of our audience, I'm afraid.
There's a thing where there's a way of making this film, which is just to collect... I imagine it's probably what they did. Collect all the great rock anecdotes you've ever heard from roadies and road crew and put them together and then make them. But then what they've done with it is then make a story that is resonant beyond that. And they've done that by finding that story of friendship. Mm. And the reason I think that this film is a masterpiece and has lasted more than other mockumentary films and more than other spoof films is that you can relate to it. What stunned me is we were talking about when we first saw it. When I first saw it, I was into heavy metal. You were introduced to it by our mate Steve, who
just wore Megadeth t-shirts the whole time.
So it was an important thing to sort of rock fans and heavy metal fans because it was about your thing. And the lovely thing about heavy metal fans is they're a little tiny tribe who no one thinks is cool, really. So this being about your subject, it's a train spottery thing. Oh, someone else is into train spotting. there's a real sort of fandom thing there. But what's great is that that form of music has kind of fallen by the wayside. It's probably less relevant than it was in the 80s. And yet, it's not about heavy metal. It's about any group endeavour. It's about any creative endeavour, which is why when you watch films like Anvil, that weirdly they seem to follow the story of the real heavy metal band. They follow exactly the same structure. But also, if you see any films about anyone doing anything, where they're on tour or doing comedy or anything, that backstage feel, that loneliness, that boredom, that tedium, that trying to do something nice for an audience in the face of indifference, that's a common experience. What I love about it is it appeals beyond heavy metal fans. It could have been any joke.
Yeah, I mean, I love music and I will listen to anything. And if heavy metal comes on, I won't turn it off. I won't go to it as a matter of, you know, primary choice. But, you know, I will welcome anything into my ears within reason. And so I don't watch it for that. But the music stands up, and it has to in that film.
Yeah.
The music, they have to play their own stuff. It has to be good. The tunes are incredibly synced. You know, Mel turned 50 recently, and I'm a lot younger than her, which is great. And so I've always really enjoyed her birthdays. And we thought long and hard about how we would show her how much we loved her. And we decided that we would play Stonehenge.
Wow.
Not only that, and I play guitar badly. I'm a pianist, really. I play guitar. So I thought, I'm going to learn the bass. Because everyone says you've got to be Derek Small. So I learned the bass.
Born to it.
Our friend Dylan, who played with the Blockheads, is a proper, proper, proper drummer and who used to be in the Light Lunch Band when we were kids and we did the lunchtime show. He was on drums. Mel's brother, who's a great keyboardist, was Savage. And she didn't know we were going to do it, and we did it in her garden. And the best thing was, and when it came to the little mandolin bit, all her mates came out dressed as druids. And her brother-in-law, who's a set designer, had parked up at the back of the house and with a fishing rod had a mini stone, a perfect Stonehenge. And we ended up playing the track three times because she just went mad. We were crying. That's how much Spinal Tap means to me, because it's not just a funny film. It's this incredible glue amongst all of us who love it, you know, and who've gone through those experiences. And genuinely, that was... I think the best thing we could have done was to have played Stonehenge.
The reason you can do that, and you're saying the music, the weird thing about it, the music is both bad and good.
Yes,
and
the lyrics are hilariously execrable. Yeah.
But they've not made it so you wouldn't want to listen
to
them.
The bigger the cushion.
The sweeter the cushion.
But it's...
Or so I have read.
Where? He's read no other books, just that one. But what's amazing about it is they've made a decision that is absolutely crucial if you're going to do any kind of parody. And I think Christopher Guest has made this mistake in other films afterwards.
Mm.
He has decided, or the team has decided, just how bad or good Spinal Tap are. It is totally clear that they've got a following. They don't play to nobody. Yeah. They're quite good at songwriting. They're not a bad band, which makes the film so much better. But there's so many films you watch which are supposed to be parodies of things like people making a film or people making putting on a stage show, where they haven't decided whether the entertainment they're putting on is bad or good. It's not quite clear.
Yeah.
The clarity of Tap, that they are okay.
They're not a bad band, but they're a very desperate band, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because they go through endless moments of reinvention, which if you ascribe them to, I don't know, David Bowie or someone like that, or Madonna, you go, brilliant, look at this person reinventing themselves constantly. By dint of imagination, that's not what's going on with Tap. They're doing it out of desperation. They're going, oh, we can't be Merseybeat, we've got to be hippies now, we need to be filmed through a kaleidoscope lens, and then we need to be, we better go heavy metal, haven't we? And by two-thirds of the way through, this is Spinal Tap, they're going, it's prog, isn't it? Yeah, we better be Stonehenge.
You're absolutely right.
And they're almost at the point of going, well, we could do Saucy Jack, the Jack the Ripper.
He's a naughty one.
The joke there is that's perfect character, because the idea was what mustn't happen is they mustn't get off the bus.
Yeah,
and it doesn't
never
matter
get off the bus.
Whether they like or don't like the music, if they're doing Jazz Odyssey or anything. The point is their adolescence must not be stopped. They are the preserved moose line. The point is they are there to preserve those two little kids.
No, they endure. That's the thing about Tap. And that's I can understand that. You know,
Tap abides.
My fingers are on that ledge until someone kicks them right off. You will do anything.
Yeah,
if you're lucky enough, part of it's just staying in, you know, and I understand that sometimes people don't like what you do and sometimes they do. And it's, you have to open yourself up to the ebb and flow of failure and limited success. And I think that's exactly what Tap have done. And if you said, what I love is that idea they were the Originals, but then there was another band called the Originals. So they're not even original enough to give themselves another name. They just say that they're the new Originals. And it's things like, it's so It's so, the quality of the improvising is so extraordinary, and it comes from, they're obviously very fine comedic minds, and they make great jokes, but actually the genius of it is they're not trying to make jokes. No. They have worked and been inhabiting those characters for years before those cameras roll.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they are friends, they love each other in real life. There's a joy about being each other's company. And sometimes when I watch it, God only knows, I've watched that film hundreds of times, I don't want to see Nigel and David, I just want to see Christopher and Michael laughing.
Yes.
Just laughing at each other.
They've got some stuff prepared. You can see they've got I Love Lucy. They've both thought of Lucy beforehand.
They've probably thought of choked on somebody else's vomit.
They've built a prop amp that goes up to 11. So there's some preparation.
You can't dust vomit. Yeah,
right. And can I just say, you know, on IMDb, and I only found this out recently, and I actually felt tearful, is it's the only film that IMDb scores up to 11.
Perfect.
I didn't even realise it goes to 11. I actually feel emotional about that. That's how much of this film.
And also, what would be great is if it only got 9 out of 11. But they prepared it, so they kind of, they've got some jokes, but the jokes aren't the important thing. The other lovely thing, which again doesn't happen in improvisation films, Tony Way, I think, pointed this out to me, the actor. He said, if you watch an improvised film like a Will Ferrell, Steve Carell kind of movie now, you'll see lots of one shots of someone's head saying a line, cut to the other person's head, they say a line. And what it is, they filmed 12 lines and the best one's gone in. And it's been assembled in the edit just like this. But in Tap, all three of them, all four of them are in shot at the same time, making each other laugh. And that doesn't happen in film enough. It certainly doesn't happen in comedy films.
No.
And the joy of a comedy film is seeing people interact.
And I think they don't know about Shit Sandwich. I think Ryan has put that in. Because you can see that Christopher Guest he's laughing. So I think Shit Sandwich has come in as a... I'm just going to chuck that into the mix.
That comes straight after treading water in a sea of retarded sexuality, doesn't it?
Which is a fantastic line.
What's great is he's got a piece of paper there. The last time I watched it, the thing I spotted was the number of really sharp edits there are at the end of a line, which A, get you out of the gag quickly as an audience member, but also are probably just before they crack up.
Yes.
They're cutting just at the moment someone was about to crack.
Didn't he try to use take one as much as possible?
Really?
He was putting the thing together. Yeah. I read that somewhere.
So, because there is a real freshness to it.
Yeah.
Because even when you... I love improvising. I love playing. But once you hit you get a good line, it's... And you know this from writing. You don't want to kill your babies.
Yeah.
You will repeat that good joke even if you're on the 10th or 12th take of that, and it's not improvising anymore.
Yes.
You're self-editing, you're cherry-picking, and that it's dead. And I think, you're absolutely right, I think he's caught where he can, the first takes, so there is that joy, and that slight fear as well about who's going to say what. And you can almost watch them in that scene where they're talking about their reviews. As you would in a real group, who's going to chip in next?
Yeah.
You said that, I'm going to sit back a bit.
They're prepped, they know themselves, and they're aware of who's going to say what and what the characters are, so they can feel their way around each other. But what you're feeling as well there with them going for the first take and the freshness is this is a new idea that Rob Reiner and these guys have gone, what if we, which is the story behind it, is they were trying to get the money together to pay for a script, or someone offered the money for a script, and they went, we can't do that. That's not what we're going to do. And they spent the script money on a 20-minute taster tape, which is, I think it's Stonehenge they made as the taster tape. 20 minutes of that said, proof of concept, this is it. But if you want to see a script, which is how you raise the money for a film, we can't show you that. And there's a feeling going, oh, this is brand new.
Mm.
Really exciting. And I don't think there's any other film that captures that. And in terms of comedy, the reason this is a comedian's favourite film is how often do you see someone trying something brand new?
Yeah.
Buster Keaton? I mean, who? That doesn't happen very often.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And what I love about the structure, as you say, it's totally about, it's about a film about love. It's a film about how love endures in difficult situations.
Yeah.
And that is platonic love, but nonetheless extremely intense. But within that, that each song is a set piece where something ridiculous happens. And so they almost have sketch element of you could take
yes.
them out and just watch them without any of the wraparound and just think that is hilarious. Whether it's, you know, Derek being stuck in that weird pod and
apparently
the guy with
yes.
the oxyacetylene lamp.
That's amazing. That is a masterclass. I looked at that again and thought, this is Laurel and Hardy. It's like you trap Harry Shearer in a giant chrysalid and then go, how many gags can we get out of this? We're going to try five ways of getting him out. First of all, you've got to realise he's trapped, you've got to wait for the penny to drop, then you've got to watch someone trying to get him out, and then the banging gets so loud that it's putting the musicians off what they're doing. Then there's a flamethrower, then he gets out at the moment at which the other two get back into their pods, and then it eats him like a
Venus flytrap. That's for me, that's when he gets back in and it just, yes.
And the arm out doing the heavy metal thing, which apparently he borrowed from the guy from Saxon, who used to play his bass with one hand and do the devil horns with the other, which is brilliant because it's really heavy metal, but also reveals that your bass lines are not very complicated.
No, well, I can attest to that. Yeah. Having learned it, they're not that complicated. But the fact he's playing it in the chrysalid, he's playing almost upright, but still the commitment is incredible. But every single one, whether it's, I can't remember which song, maybe it's Hellhole, I can't remember, but you've got Tufnell just leaning backwards and then not being able to get up. And then you've got him being spun, and they could have stopped that. Way before, but why when it's so good? And instead of just picking him up, he spins him like a crab on his back around and around. And then, you know, you obviously got Stonehenge or something. It's just, wonderful.
There are stupid things that happen to people in bands when they think it looks cool. I remember the first thing I did when I first was in a band was I thought, you know what's cool? Dark glasses. Do you know what's not cool? Falling off stage. Because I imagine Lou Reed has a man who goes, edge of the stage, every so often, but you'd fall off. So all these things that you see is, I remember watching bands as a kid and thinking that all the other movements, apart from the actual playing, was the cool bit. Like wanging your whammy bar and throwing your hand around, jumping off the stacks. And when you're a kid, you think that's how you play a guitar. And I think Spinal Tap, the joy of it is that I think they still think that's the best bit about being, that the musicianship is.
Because they're 10. They're 10-year-old boys.
Yes. It's watching children. But actually, one of the things that's really nice as well is these guys can play instruments. And when you watch, you know that when the music's playing, their fingers are in pretty much the right place.
Oh, totally. And there's a joy, you know, you can't teach people to love playing music. You can teach them to, you know, be taught where their finger should be on a fretboard or on a keyboard. But there's a, when they're playing, it's just, they are a proper band. They're tight. They look at each other. It's all those things that a tutor wouldn't necessarily tell you to do. It's, you know, although Derek never looks at the drummer. So Derek's sort of, it's sort of part of the rhythm
section. He knows he's going to kill him in a minute.
It's true,
They've got a string of dead drummers behind them, haven't they?
There's that brilliant bit at the end where the pyro goes off behind them and you realise it's the drummer.
And then all the Japanese kids cheer.
They've been waiting for that bit.
But also the detail, you know, going into the names of Ronnie Pudding. was Ronnie Pudding.
Ronnie Pudding, of course, and I brought this along as a fact because otherwise there's no point doing this. Ronnie Pudding was played by Danny Kortchmar. Danny Kortchmar was a session guitarist who worked with Lyndon Ronstadt and Harry Nilsson, and James Taylor was Carole King's guitarist.
Oh, you've nudged me right
produced
off.
Produced The Boys of Summer by Don Henley.
Really?
That's how musical this film is. I spent hours looking up Danny Kortchmar today because I wondered innocently who was Ronnie Pudding. But that's the kind of prep we do for these podcasts. That's the kind of gem I can bring you.
But isn't that great, the fact that it's populated by brilliant musicians?
It gives it that feeling of these people, they love this. It's not done with contempt.
No.
They're not outsiders, inside this world.
No, it's not cynical, is it? Which it very easily could be. It reminded me, when I was watching it, a few years ago, I was on tour with a band, and there's a lot of hanging around and travelling and not doing the thing that you're
Computer
there for.
Computer magic.
Yeah. I thought, I want to watch something, and I said to someone, is there a really good documentary about being on tour with a band? And someone said, yeah, there's a documentary called something like So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star about the Kersal Flyers.
Pub rock.
It's a 1976 BBC documentary, so I found it from somewhere and sat and watched it in my hotel room. And it was just a load of people sitting around, not really being on stage and being bored. And I mean, I'm just watching what I'm doing. Why am I watching this? This is a bizarrely recursive process I seem to have engaged in here. But it reminded me a lot of that. I think they must have seen Say You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star before they made This Is Spinal Tap.
Well, they watched a lot of it. They watched The Last Waltz.
It's got a lot of that in common, that kind of... If you see Meeting People Is Easy, Radiohead's one, it's just lots of just very bleak movement from place to place. There's lots of travel staring.
And there is, but of course, that would just be deeply tedious. Watching people being bored is boring, you know. But the thing with Tap is there's every single frame has a subtext. And I particularly love the backstage, in the hotel stuff. There's Cindy, obviously, Cindy's first moustache.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, special friend.
Yeah. So Cindy's
my special new friend.
But it's very innocent. It's not sex and drugs. There's rock and roll, but actually they're like, as you say, they're little boys. Get a sense that they're sexually virile. They've got, you know, foil-wrapped zucchini down their trousers.
Armadillos down their trousers, but they're not real armadillos, are they? They're fake armadillos. There's a brilliant bit where they're at the Polymer Records party with Bobby Flagman. Dennis Eaton Hogg. And they've all got cold sores.
Can we just dwell on that name for a moment?
Dennis Eaton Hogg.
Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg.
Perfect. But they've all got matching cold sores.
Yes.
And there was a big cut, which was they'd all caught them off the lead singer of the support band, who they'd
all
had.
That was in the additional materials. There's a lot more about
that. And
what's
lovely is by removing that, A, you get an extra joke, which at third viewing you go, they've all got cold sores. Yeah. And also, it means that they're not being beastly. They can remain as children. It keeps the innocence up. And your first thing when you probably do a first pass on the script is, we need lots of sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Mm.
And there's almost none.
Well, because
lots of rock and roll.
Nigel's only love really is David St. Hubbins.
Yeah.
And his guitar collection. don't touch it. But
don't even look at it.
Don't even look at it.
Do you play all? I mean, do you actually play all these or...?
I play them and I cherish them. Mm-hmm. This is the top of the heap right here. There's no question about it. Look at the flame on that one. It's perfect. 1959. You know, it just... You can... listen.
How much is this?
Just listen for a minute. Sustain. Listen to it.
I'm not hearing anything.
You would, though, if it were playing, because it really... It's famous for its sustain. I mean, you can just hold it...
Well, I mean, so you'd have to...
You can go and have a bite. No. You'll still be hearing that one.
Yeah.
Can you hold it
to say? You sure?
And I love the solo with... It's a great moment. It's just a lovely little set piece where Nigel's got... he's playing the guitar, then he's kicking the... the guitar, and then gets a violin and scrapes it, and then just stops to just slightly tune it, and then goes back. It's just wonderful.
It's a bit of a departure from the kind of thing you normally play. Yeah.
It's a horn part.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, just simple lines intertwining.
What do you call this?
Well, this piece is called Lick My Love Pump.
Again, it's in the editing structure. You know this tour is going badly. It starts off going badly and gets poetically worse. You can see that they've built this beautiful structure where it starts, the venues are quite good, little things go wrong, Ian Faith can't get them, X, Y, Z, and then by the end it's Puppet Show and Spinal Tap and Jazz Odyssey, and they're playing to nobody. The gigs are arranged in such a beautiful order that when they do I only noticed it this time round. When there's the Detrox tape thing where they're swearing at each other trying to record.
Yeah.
For the first time ever, I went, what are they recording? And I thought, oh, the bad version of this film just has every band joke you can do, including a recording session. This has a iron cast plot line of a tour going wrong, in which they put a really nice gigs recording scene, but they shouldn't be recording anything at that point. It's almost the only bit I went, oh, this could have just been a load of sketches. But they've done something beautiful with a story of failure and decline and moving from being relevant to irrelevant. And that lovely moment at the end where all you want to do is for them to come back together again. I noticed this time around, Nigel leaves 15 minutes before the end. That's the third act. Mm. It's 15 minutes long. It's so short. You lose Nigel and you go, oh, it's not the same without Nigel. And he comes back and you punch the air that he's back. And they found that story, slow decline, lose the brothers are breaking up and then find them again. It's just, it's peerlessly good writing, but made in the edit.
If you'd be interested in reforming and doing a tour, Japan.
So you've come back to replug our life support systems in. Is that it, by the grace of by the stroke of your hand, you're going to set, is that what you're going to do? You're going to bring us back to life? Is that what you've come here for?
I've come.
I mean, it's, I don't, you, the fucking nerve that you display in coming.
That's just passing on the information, really.
You look at Nigel on the side of the stage and he's asking for permission to come back on.
Yeah,
because that's the thing about
Can
that
I come
love
and
story.
Play?
Yeah, that is the thing. Nigel reveres David. They love each other, but for Nigel, David is everything. And he's just, he's almost sort of bouncing up and down. He's obviously, you know, he's lip syncing along to those ridiculous lyrics. And it's, you know, almost a sort of cursory sort of nod of the head from David, and then on he bounds like a Labrador and just, you know, all this sort of tongue going. And you know.
At the beginning, they do that lovely thing, which is in all rock documentaries, which is as you introduce people, the captions come up. And there's a brilliant, everyone, the Artie Fufkin caption is the best timed caption.
That's one of the best visual jokes I've ever seen.
Yeah.
We've all seen it, but I'm going to describe it anyway, because what the hell? Artie Fufkin from Palmer Records arrives and introduces himself. Hi, Artie Fufkin, Palmer Records. Artie Fufkin, Palmer Records. Hi, Artie Fufkin, Palmer Records. Artie Fufkin, Palmer Records. After about eight of these, a caption comes up saying, Artie Fufkin, Palmer Records.
But they use those, and I noticed the first time this around, that at the beginning, when they're introduced, and clearly the way to introduce them is David St. Hubbins, lead singer, Nigel Tufnell, lead guitar. It goes David St. Hubbins, lead guitar. Nigel Tufnell, lead guitar. They have the same job. They fought about how to be credited.
That.
And the thing is, they're totally equal.
Yeah.
I think the relationship between a singer and a guitarist is different than a relationship, which is basically, it's Francis Rossi and Rick Parfitt.
When they're saying
they're
at the end,
they're both lead guitar. They fight over it.
But like he's going through the set list. You know, Nigel wrote that, and then Derek Smalls goes, "Well, that's we've got a tight 10 minutes." You know, they are nothing without one another. Because I bet you, if David had left and Nigel was putting together a set list, he also would only have 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's just that they have to be together in order to have any sort of degree of success and joy in their lives. Oh, I love Artie Fufkin. Also Bobby Fleckman. I mean, that scene. I mean, one of my favourite moments, and it's just a look by In Faith by Tony Hendra, which is money talks bullshit wise.
That looks amazing.
It is that classic doer Brit versus sort of effusive American.
There's an amazing dynamic in it, and the core of it is Tony Hendra. And Tony Hendra is a fascinating character because I found this out researching for this. Tony Hendra is the missing link between British 60s satire and the American thing, because he went over to America to work on National Lampoon. He did the National Lampoon radio show that turned into the thing that turned into Saturday Night Live. They poached the cast. It's all Belushi and Aykroyd and everyone. Basically, he was the Brit who went abroad, but he was at Cambridge with the Pythons.
Yeah.
And he claims that John Cleese asked him to join Monty Python. Sent him a letter and said, Cleese is so ahead of his
time. I think his claim is looking shaky already, isn't
but
it?
Said, I'm putting this thing together. Do you want to join anywhere? I would have been no use anyway. But they were mates and they were friends. He was friends with Chapman. He's gone over there. He was one of the original producers on Spitting Image. And Peter Fluck, who did Spitting Image, said, Tony Hendra moved to America from fear that Britain, being a small island, might one day run out of alcohol. And he's got this sense of, he's come over there and he's dropped into this world of Americans, including Christopher Guest, who grew up in the UK.
Yeah.
And
who's now a Lord.
He's a Lord.
Lord Hayden Guest.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a hereditary position. I don't think he can sit in the House of Lords anymore because they've changed the rules. But he's an Anglophile. They're all Anglophiles. And this whole film is this beautiful love letter to the British accent, because they're all doing brilliant British accents, some of them, and God, is it a June Chadwick who plays Janine? That voice, oh. That flat voice.
Janine is incredible.
They love She's her because she just can't not be funny.
And can I actually? I watched it again, obviously recently, but I was surprised she didn't get a writing credit because yeah. She too is involved in the improvisation.
She
and
are.
Janine
yeah.
is an they, extraordinary.
They asked cat. Apparently. They asked. They said they wanted. They got a four-way writing credit. They asked for a writing credit to be given to the entire cast, yeah. And the Screenwriters Guild said that's impossible to do. Yeah. But they apparently did.
No, I mean, I'm sure. Precedent. I mean, because they're very, you know, you can't be a brilliant improviser like they are without wanting to include everyone. That's interesting. That got the Screenwriters Guild. How fascinating.
There are rules, but I think the love affair about with Britishness, with the flatness, with the quality that voice gives, and it's very odd as a British person watching it going, I bet this sounds amazing if you're not British. I mean, it sounds pretty good if you're British, but it probably sounds like the equivalent of what we do in The Shadows, the delight there is in the New Zealand accent in that. This is an accent movie, and everyone's really enjoying it. Those accents
are really
peerless.
But Tony Hendra's a really interesting character. Sorry, Ian Faith's character. Tony Hendra's Ian Faith is an interesting character because he's furious.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a sort of... Yeah, Davidson Hubbins gets riled occasionally. Janine gives a little bit of spice to the mix. But Ian Faith is furious all the time. And he hasn't got a good word to say about anybody. He's actually... Sir Dennis is on the phone and he has a pop at him. He'll have a pop at the, you know, the bands they come across. He's just angry. And those cutaway scenes are really... When he's just taking a cricket bat to anything.
Well,
it's the manager who's being rock and roll and the rock and rollers who are being biddable.
One of the things that's about... he's obviously enormously charismatic and likeable, but you don't really like him as much as you like the tap. He's the grown-up. He's the dad. He's the sort of the patriarchal force through it. And you're not very happy. Do you know where it's nice? In little kiddie world with the band. And it's this lovely thing about innocence and naivety and not losing that. It just occurred to me. He's lost his faith. He's someone who's not got faith in rock and roll like they've got. It's a good bit of naming. He's supposed to be the guy who believes in the band, and he's the one who sort of doesn't.
He strides around, as he says, good in, you know, to this business to have a good solid bit of wood in your hand, whatever it is, you know. But he wants to. He's furious and he wants to hurt people, you know, because he's the one, as you say, at the sharp end of all the responsibility when things... But he also... One of the great lines in the film was when he said, you know, Boston's council, it's not a big college town. And he just throws...
You're a liar!
It's just thrown... So many great lines are just thrown away. That great line when the guy goes, we got to sit in the lobby and wait for the limo. It's just... Imagine somebody saying, I can't talk to you because I've got to go... Just over here and do nothing.
Because that's the relationship we have with our great touring mates.
I'm going to just wait for something else in plain sight and tell you about it. As you say, that great opening by Rob Reiner, who's setting out his stall. He's saying, not only will this be impeccably directed, it's going to have an incredibly authentic feel. But
yeah,
I've
got a camera behind me.
I've got all
the
trappings.
Baseball cap. Yeah,
cap is fine. But the most punctual. He's the most punctual band. The idea that
it's a really good. I mean, it sets him up as a character. It sets him up as a naive fan because he hasn't noticed these things aren't good. They're not the best things you could say about the band. But he's an unquestioning fan. He talks about falling in love with them. Oh, you're being judged in this as well because the band aren't that great, and you're so in love with them. You're aware that you've got an unreliable narrator. Someone who will forgive them everything. Because he's damning them with faint praise immediately, so it's immediately funny. But also, that's part of the judging and letting the audience know, how good are this band? And you go, well, this idiot likes them. But he's a bit of an idiot. Look at his stupid hat. He can't fold his arms. You've got this feeling of that's, again, it's holding the audience's hand and saying, this is exactly how good or bad this band are going to be. And when you see... This film has been made again and again and again. If you watch BBC Four, this film is on almost every week in the form of any documentary about any band. And they all fit over this form. They're all on rails. They're made by fans. They're not questioning enough. They're too in love. And one of the reasons I think this film works totally is you recognise it straight away, whether you've seen it. Unlike a lot of other mockumentaries which are about things, I haven't seen a documentary about a dog show. And I like Best in Show. Mm. But I don't know whether that's just what a dog show documentaries are like. But I really know... This is what the story of a band is always like when it's told by an unquestioning fan, which it won't be quite questioning enough.
I love Best in Show, but I think you're watching fabulous actors play hilarious characters.
Yes.
With Spinal Tap, you They are those people. They have lived that life.
It's a
qualitative
difference, isn't it, between them? And I love that. I think Mighty Wind is absolutely adorable film. I think it's brilliant, and it's telling that is it For Your Consideration that he did.
Yeah.
I watched that and went, oh God, this has got everything that Spinal Tap gets right, it gets wrong. You're not sure whether the film's any good or not. And it's simple mistakes like that this is so beautifully tagged and signposted and generous to its audience. It says, pick up the clues, follow this through. We're going to put the breadcrumbs through so you know what's going on. It's about these two friends. It makes everything so clear. And the problem with an improvised movie is it can be a rambling shambles. And this is tight. It's 1 hour, 23 minutes long.
Yeah, no, it's nothing. It's
not a wasted gag.
I'm going to ask a question. Has everybody in this room seen Spinal Tap? Hands up who hasn't seen it.
Wow.
Well, A, none of what we've said will make any sense. I did sort of wonder at the beginning which we should sort of pray-see what it was about. But I can't commend it, and I can't sort of recommend it enough. It is extraordinary, and it's so brief, but it's so momentous. And I've probably seen it, over 50 times, I'd say.
Yeah.
We watched it, as I say, it's accompanied me throughout the various sort of permutations of life. But we actually went on tour with a band for a while, and it was the only video we had in the tour bus. Because
wow.
There was just, and Denny, this amazing guitarist who toured us, would just noodle about and sort of come up with things that he thought the Thamesman might have come up with, or, you know, it would be a sort of starting point for some sort of improvisation. People might say, oh, you know, some of those set pieces, whether it's Stonehenge, whether it's, you know, the chrysalid, don't happen. They really, they do. They happen all the time, and they happen, as I know, in tiny art spaces. For example, once we were in Edinburgh, again, Mel and I laughed for about 3 months about this and quoted Tap a lot. We did, in Edinburgh, you have an hour slot, you do your show, and someone's always coming in after you with a very intense sort of post-feminist interpretation of Equus, or something amazing's happening, or some theatre, some
plate
juggling.
Spinning.
Yeah, this is something. And we shared a space with about seven or eight other sort of troops, and there was always a bucket backstage. There was always and Mel's bladder isn't good, it gives way a lot. And she said, I've got to go for a wee, and I said, there's no time. We'd had clearance, which is the sort of byword for get your shit together, it's time to go on. And she says, you weed in the bucket. And you always in Edinburgh promise to see everyone's shows. Everyone you love is doing a show and you have to go and see all the shows. And our friend was doing the show after ours. So we said, well, we've done our gig, we'll stay on. And she was doing a show a lot about her Catholic upbringing. And in the middle of it, she became this sort of furious nun who went backstage and got a bucket and a large paintbrush and doused everyone with Mel's piss. And it just, we've got billions of stories. They all feel like something that could have been in Spinal Tap. Because when you have props and egos and time pressures and money pressure, things like that are routine. They just are.
Astonishing story. I think, it might be the wrong bit of the film, but there's one of the live set pieces. I think it might be Stonehenge with the wrong size prop. Happened to Black Sabbath, and there was a lot of conversation saying, oh, did Spinal Tap borrow the idea?
Yeah.
I think in Spinal Tap, it's Nigel does the dimensions for the Stonehenge prop and writes 18 inches when he means 18 feet, and the prop's too small. Black Sabbath did the other way around and wrote 18 metres when they meant 18 foot, and it wouldn't fit in the van. And apparently that happened after Spinal Tap. literally 6 months afterwards. So everyone went, oh, it was just, these things happen because of the nature of doing this, the naivety you have to do it. The people will get caught up in these daft anecdotes.
David Niven, who, there was an issue with the dimensions of his swimming pool, and as a result, that property still has the deepest swimming pool. It's something like 40 metres deep, right? Something like that. You'll have to look it up, but it's literally, he got the depth measurement wrong. And it's just basically
like a well.
Yeah, it's basically a well.
Niven's Hollywood Well. I saw them at the Bullen Gate. They were great.
There's always a sort of flavour of reality. What I like about Tap as well is it because it doesn't go too much. The sex is innocent and silly, and there's no drugs.
Yeah.
There's no.
No, no.
I think there's a sniffing thing, and I thought, is that snuff? It's so innocent. My brain didn't.
Just but
we're
not with
cocaine.
Artie Fufkin when Smalls is discharging his sinuses.
There's
that's
a little bit
disgusting.
And there's a little bit, and I thought, is
he's
that
not even blowing into the thing. He's going. And then trying to catch it. And then trying to, it's horrible.
Derek Smalls has a pipe in the first interview segment, yeah, doesn't he? I think he's smoking a pipe.
He's thinking. Yeah. But what you forget as well is that the use of the cast you've got. You've got the core guys and things. And you forget, I remember Derek Smalls being a massive part of Tap. He's not in it a lot. No. You've got Harry Shearer and you are letting him, because you filmed 50 hours of it, have tiny slices of detail, but through those slices is written the reality of that character and the life of him, so that you, I don't know, when Archie Harm bustles in for half a line, you know the guy's backstory, which is, again, how a documentary works. A documentary glimpses people's real lives and you're peeping through a window and you know that person's going to bustle on and go somewhere else after this. And the thing about Tap, even though it is a series of bravura, over-the-top performances, is for some reason, I think those mimes are still doing parties around Hollywood.
Billy Crystal, mime is money, and that's kind of, you know... That's
Bruno Kirby's still driving that cab around. Everyone they're
Fred
using...
Fred Willard. I could watch Fred Willard do anything forever.
Me too. I think he's
just wonderful.
Utter genius.
He plays the guy at the airbase who does the... you ever see your Four Jacks and a Jill? Just the most astonishing, wrong guy.
He does kind of... Micah sort of conviviality so brilliantly, doesn't he?
But I've had gigs where, because in that he says, let's just start at 1700 and then Derek goes, well, that's in what 50 hours? And and he says, yeah, but we just thought we'd get it over and done with. And I've had so many times we've turned up and it's been casual brutality of just like...
we're big fans of you, not you per se, but the whole rock and roll.
The genre,
most perfectly insulting thing to say.
It's just this...
Actually, that helps you. You can't help but feel for them. And obviously, the point is, there's an easy version of this film where they're pricks. And they're sexist pricks, and they're boorish pricks, and you do them smashing hotel rooms, and you lose all sympathy for them. And that's a very funny... That would be a very funny film, a kind of jackassy film about some pricks. But it's... Every time people are mean to them, you want to cuddle...
They're not pricks. They're always trying to learn. Like the whole the idea that the original cover for Smell the Glove, the album is Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg will not countenance it because, as Bobby says, you're putting a greased naked woman in a dog collar
on all fours
with a leash. And Nigel doesn't get this and thinks, well, what's wrong with being sexy? And they have to explain that sexist is not the same as sexy. But again, it's. And when they learn, for example, that the rival band have got an album cover where the man is sort of naked and chained, they go, oh, I understand. I understand now that actually if the singer is the supposed sort of victim or it's a lower power status. So, but there's no anger about that. No. They've learned something. I like that.
That gentleness and warmth. I think the other thing about it, which is really startling, is that it dates really well. I think a version of it that was a bit more edgy about the band would have dated badly. There's one or two moments. I think Ian Faith bashing the cricket bat into his hand.
Janine going,
that's dated a little bit badly. Like, sort of, it looks like he's in a clouter for being an uppity woman. But what's amazing, this film's a fair age now, and it's about sexists, and it's about male power fantasies and things like that. And weirdly, it feels so beautifully innocent. It means you can watch it totally safely.
Because they're vulnerable, actually. They're not predators. And that's why that film has lasted.
The security guard's face, when she uncovers Derek Small's tinfoil-wrapped cucumber down his spandex trousers, she rolls her eyes.
Here goes another one.
Yeah. And it's just the idea of these little boys. And I think the lovely thing about it is it's about something which could have been, again, vicious or crude. The temptation to do crudity. Weirdly, it's a very innocent film. I remember watching it, my mum coming in during the one really sweary scene with Ian and Janine, and her rolling her eyes and going, oh, it's one of those sort of films, and you want to grab her and go, it's not, it's just lovely.
See, I love the bit where Davidson Hubbard and Janine are in the tour bus and Viv Savage is playing some terrible sort of 1984 computer game, and he's wearing... she's made him a jumper with some horrific sort of planetary sort of arrangement on there, and... it's such a sweet moment because he's just, it's like he's with his mum. He's going, can I not wear that in front of the boys? I don't want to wear, you know. And it's just a little snapshot of their relationship where, you know, he adores her, but and he's always supporting her. He's always getting out her drawings. You know, Janine's done a version of outfits where, hey, you're dressed as a goat, Nigel. And, you know, but he's a supportive.
They're not animals, they're zodiacal signs.
A supportive boyfriend, and she is a strong woman, and that's why that film, the core of that film, hasn't dated.
Yeah, it's nice actually, because she behaves like a mum. Ian Faith, it's mum and dad are fighting, is why that scene with them swearing at each other is so distressing. The mum energy and the dad energy clash up, and the little boys are sort of lost in the fight. Like
and
a
Nigel, the petulant sort of child that is just... There's that scene in the airport where they're waiting for their flight, and there's just a gap in the seat. He's moved one seat away.
Yeah.
He's wearing a ludicrous Stetson, you know, because they're off to wherever, you know. And he's got the Zodiac. She's done the full Zodiac, hasn't she? The astrological predictions for the gig. And, you know, he's got it, but he doesn't want to read it. But also, the truth of touring is it's lonely. There are moments where it feels unspeakably glamorous, but those moments you can replicate at home. Like, when I'm touring and I feel most alive is when I realise, as a grown-up, I can eat all of the minibar. And that's not necessarily about being on tour. That's just about you get a sense of personal freedom. Mm. And sometimes that sense is more augmented when you're on the road, maybe, I don't know. But it's also lonely, and it captures that. Like, when Janine says she's gonna meet him on one of the tour gigs, Nigel's deflated, he jumps on his back like a child, and he's sort of, because he can't wait to see his girlfriend. And it's just cute, and I'm like that. You know, I'm the joy of seeing somebody you love when you are, I don't know, somewhere on the road, and you're
in an unreal space, and suddenly something real is there. Something there's something magical about this film in that it's lasted. I mean, it's now been voted like the greatest comedy film of all time in polls. It didn't get very well reviewed at the time. It sort of survived on video, like a lot of these films, a lot of cult films, With Man and I or Big Lebowski or this. And it's endlessly rewatchable because I think there's something just good at its heart that makes you feel nice about being a human being who wants to make stuff.
Yeah, and I think it's about staying in the game. You know, they stay in it long enough for the Japanese to suddenly become hugely interested in their back catalogue, and then it ends obviously with them playing... I should have said spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it. But, you know, and so it has a real destination.
Sex Farm gets into the top five.
Sex Farms, yeah.
And always a happy ending when Sex Farm...
Is it our version? I've forgotten how good that line was. Is it our version? As if
someone would cover Sex Farm. Sex Farm belongs to Spinal Tap.
I think it's Derek who says that. And it's... because Derek's got that huge handlebar moustache. So much of what he says is just slightly lost and muffled. But those beautiful eyes, there's a lovely shot of him.
Yeah.
Is it when... The Flower People, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love you. And his dewy eyes.
Listen, it's getting louder every day.
Of course, the sort of aftershock of this film was they didn't really get royalties. They didn't, you know. And so it's, I think now in the wake of various lawsuits, about which I know very little, but I know they rumble on, you know.
It's nearly
it's not 400 available.
Million. They're suing for nearly
400 million.
400 million because of various legal reasons. But again, one of those things which is clearly a perfect artefact made by these creators about a bunch of creators who aren't treated very well. And it actually came true. So again, the truth is through it like rock. Not the musical genre rock, the seaside substance rock.
But the amount of sort of, I can't remember they call it, something like collateral accountancy or something horrific. There's a term for it where...
You keep hiding profits.
Yes.
That's an interesting thing about Spinal Tap as well. As a kid watching it, and I love this about comedies, very often comedy would give you a glimpse into an adult world and they'd sort of wink and go, this is how it's going to work, kids. And there's that lovely, a lot of it's in Ian Faith, that cynicism about, you think rock and roll's like this, it's actually about accounting and territories and Artie Fufkin and Polymer Records and kissing ass at parties. And it did feel like a little glimpse into, I know what listening to music feels like, and I know what playing the guitar feels like. Ooh, the grown-ups are going to give me a little hint of what it's like to be in this world. And that, again, felt authentic. And I think we're talking about it now going, this sounds like dialogue from Spinal Tap. They never made any money and there was some creative accounting. This is pure Spinal Tap.
It's interesting as well, those parties where Polymer Records throw, you know, this sort of, with these horrific sort of canapes and lots of champagne, they throw the party for Tap into America, that actually the band are always on the periphery. They don't, they're very awkward. You know, and I often feel like, you know... And I'm sure you guys do. I always feel like the child that's been invited to the adult party.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and everyone goes, well, and the people are talking about figures and demographics, and I just want to play. And that might say a lot more about me and my issues, but I...
That's what being creative is. Someone said there's a real tendency to feel like that very often you need to be sent out of the room or the grown-ups get on with this. And I honestly, I've never felt any different at an award ceremony or any kind of meeting going, am I allowed to be here? I always feel like Nigel at the side of the room. in my little skeleton T-shirt.
And also, I think a sense of sort of glee and childishness that your clan are with you, your tribe are with you, but also you're made to feel fraudulent by the adults. And I think then you get a sense of that with the band. They're just, you know, while the money is discussed and where all the glitz is happening around them, that's the only time you see them uncomfortable is in the Polymer Records kind of orbit.
Yes, Bobby Blackman.
Bobby, of course. How are you?
How
are
you?
How are
you?
How are
you?
You
know, you know. Hi, handsome. How you doing? All right, listen, I want you to all meet Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg. Now, he's the head of Palm Park.
We know.
You don't talk so much. Just smile and look smart.
Oh, she knows.
Dennis, come here. Come here. I want you to meet Spinal Tap, our guest of honor.
Again, your great point. This is a big movie about don't stop the bus. We mustn't get off the bus. If we get off the bus, we are dead. Or we have to grow up.
But also, if you get off the bus, it's simply telling everybody that you...
Yeah.
If you stop loving it, you shouldn't... You know, that, then, well, you, then you were never really truly a musician or,
you said it's an uncynical film. And weirdly, it's about one of the most cynical forms of ever, which is sort of packaged rebellion. What heavy metal is at its worst, which is just packaged outrage and things. They're not cynical. Weirdly, they should be. But what's great, it's an uncynical film about some uncynical people doing something they love.
But also, there's nothing in it about fame either. If you really unpick it, they don't talk about they want to be famous, they want to... They get annoyed that things are cancelled, but that's because they want to play the music.
Yeah.
They want to be on... That's all they want. They want to all be together, all doing the classics.
Every decision that has been made in the edit, or the writing, or the casting, or the is about making you feel good about these people. And that's very rare, because a lot of comedy, there's a cheap route to a quick gag very often in sort of saying someone is venal or someone is selfish. Or you're always looking for people's flaws to make jokes about. And these are four, the band's bigger than that, five very flawed people. And oddly, you still love them. And that's an incredible achievement, I think.
Because the heart, there's sweetness and love. And I know that up until relatively recently hasn't been fashionable.
Yeah.
But in my viewing choices, it's paramount. Even in the darkest, you know, if you look at something like Breaking Bad, which is, you know, it's sort of, it's Faust, isn't it? It's you make a pact with the devil. But, you know, even in the final awful dying embers of that, there is the sadness of it is that these two people...
Hope and friendship.
Yeah, they loved each other, and it was... But yeah, and the same with Tap, it's a story about, you know... being a kid and getting the joyful opportunity to still be around your best mate doing the thing you love.
I think you're making an argument for this being the greatest rom-com of all time.
Do you know, I'm down with that, you know, and it's...
There aren't enough good ones. Let's bung this in that pile.
But it's... But
when Harry Met Sally, this, it happened one night, it'd be great.
But how great that a film, the most macho thing you could think of, which is, you know, guys with guitars, you know, sort of sticking their tongues out in singlets and tight sort of lycra, sort of, who love each other. Who really, truly love each other. And when they sit in that cafe and they're trying to remember the old songs, the
biggest
jeopardy
is don't take my friend away. Yeah. And the moment you pump your fist in the air is when the friends get back together again.
Because you need those friends. They're context. They are history. They are everything. And if you lose that, you're just another person in another shit hotel playing a pentatonic scale. We've all been there, you know. It's the wraparound. That's why it speaks so much to me, because, you know, whatever you think of what any of us do, I know that I'm blessed to work with somebody I truly love. And if that all disappeared tomorrow, we'd never stop, by the way. We'd just be doing it to smaller rooms or empty rooms. But we'd never stop.
In a basement somewhere on your own.
The glue of those experiences, of the millions of gigs, of the millions of failures, actually, and the things that we did that went wrong, and the near-death experiences, and all those sorts of things.
Buckets of piss.
Yeah, all of it. The good and the bad. And that's why I love this film, because it's much more complex than an hour and 23 minutes of jokes.
I cannot think of a better place to end. That is beautiful. Thank you so much for ringing Spinal Tap. Sue Perkins.